Well, I guess this leads us to a subject worth talking about, which is it's very important to talk to the state or the substance, or if you don't talk to it, it won't talk to you. It follows the rules of ordinary etiquette, and it does not speak to strangers. But if you will say to it the simplest thing, like, hello, then it will say, hello. And you say, is someone there? He says, yes, you know, ready and willing, what's up? But if you don't speak to it, it won't do that. That is, to my mind, the strangest property of psilocybin, is this speaking in English business. I mean, LSD doesn't do that. Ayahuasca doesn't do that. Psilocybin does, for some reason. This is not my illusion. Nearly everybody who's spent time with it has commented on this. On DMT, you see who you hear on the mushrooms. On the mushrooms, you almost never encounter something that you can see. You see hallucinations, but you do not see the author of the data stream that's saying, did you know? I'll bet you did know, the standard form of address. But on DMT, they come bounding out of the woodwork. The strangest things happen on DMT, the most intense, and you can remember them. DMT is not like a psychedelic drug in the sense that you're getting into the contents of your hopes, memories, fears, and dreams. It's much more like a parallel continuum. It's much more as though you've broken through to some alien data space. One of the most puzzling things about DMT is it does not affect your mind. You know, it simply replaces the world 100% with something completely unexpected. But your relationship to that unexpected thing is not one of exaggerated fear or exaggerated acceptance, as in, oh, great, the world has just been replaced by elf machinery. Your reaction is exactly what it would be if it happened to you without DMT. You're appalled. You say, you know, what happened? Because you don't feel your mind moving. You just see that the world has been replaced by something that you could not have even conceived of or imagined before. And these entities, these things which look like dribbling, you know, self-dribbling jeweled basketballs, something that the NBA might take an interest in. You see them, and they present themselves to you. They use language to condense visible objects out of the air. Now, I don't know why they're doing that. I mean, perhaps on one level, I assume that they're trying to teach you to do that. On another level, they seem to be giving a demonstration of the fact that reality is made of language. They're saying, you know, if you don't believe reality is made of language, here, I'll make you one. And then blibbledy blibbledy blip, and there it is. And they hand it to you to be passed around in, you know, slack-jawed amazement among the human beings. This technology that they possess of these objects made of gold and emerald and chalcedony and agate that are morphing themselves even as you look at them are, you know, technological dream come true. I mean, the lapis as elf excrescence or something like that. And why they're there, I don't know. And, you know, many, many questions. Where are they when you're not stoned? You know, do they have an autonomous existence somewhere? Or do they spring into existence a microsecond before you encounter them? Are they rooted in the dynamics of your psyche? Or are they no more rooted in the dynamics of your psyche than the World Trade Center? It's not clear. I mean, I think I mentioned at some point, just briefly, that the archetype of DMT is the circus. These things are clowns at one level. They're clowns. I mean, when you think of the circus, it's a very complex archetype. The circus is for children. It's a delight. But then, you know, and you take a child to a circus and there are three rings and absurd clown antics going on. But then you lift your eyes up to the top of the tent and there the lady in the tiny spangled costume is hanging by her teeth, working without nets. It's about Eros and death. I think my first awareness of Eros was being three or four, and these women in these tiny costumes spinning around and realizing, you know, if she falls, she dies. And then away from the center ring and all this action, there are the sideshows, the goat-faced boy, the thing in the bottle, the Siamese twins, and Fuzzy Charlie. All of that is also very DMT-like. It really is the archetype of the circus. I can remember when I was a kid in this small town in Colorado, every year at the 4th of July, the carnival would come to town for a week and set up. And we anticipated it throughout the year. But as soon as the carnival came to town, then you couldn't play outside after 9 o'clock at night because carny people are different, we were told. And, you know, their means of support, sexual proclivities, and choice of intoxicants might have run counter to this Midwestern Catholic mining town I was in. And so then there's this sense of the disruption, the danger, the drama, the interest, the fun, and then they go away and life is as if they had never been there at all. And that's what DMT is like. I mean, it's a secret of such magnitude that it's inconceivable how it has ever been kept. Because, you know, in a world where information was fairly weighted, we would spend as much time talking about DMT as we spend talking about, I don't know, the West Bank or something. And as you see, by studying our newspapers, DMT is rarely, if ever, mentioned. I mean, never would be a good rule of thumb. The Western mind is very queasy around these experiences that cast into doubt its cherished illusions about how reality is put together. And when you get to DMT, you have hit the main vein. I mean, I hold it in reserve as the ultimate convincer. I mean, that's for these, there are these people running around, you know, who say, oh, you people who are into drugs, give me a good branch whiskey and a little TV. I think you're deluding yourself. Say, do you? Well, have you got 5 minutes to invest in this proposition, my cheerful friend? Because if you do, have I got news for you. It also seems to me, you know, considering the fact that DMT is a naturally occurring neurotransmitter, that you return to the baseline of consciousness in 15 minutes, that it's utterly harmless. What's the matter with our critics? Why are they so phobic of it? You know, what is it? Are you tainted forever if you know the position of your enemy? Why are they so afraid to give it a chance? Well, I think I can answer my own question, quoting a wonderful thing Tim Leary said years ago. He said, LSD occasionally causes psychotic behavior in people who have not taken it. Right. That is the problem, I believe, that these drugs are causing outbreaks of psychosis among people who won't get near them. And they are turned into frightened, paranoid order freaks reaching for, extra legal and extra constitutional means to make your life hell. Obviously, their minds have been severely bent by the absence of this drug. However, the knowledge of it seemed to practically undo them.
Next, Terence discusses the potential teachings of DMT.
The first teaching is priceless. It's that the world is beyond your ability to conceive or imagine. So give up any short-term plan to conceive or imagine. The worth in these psychedelics is simply that they allow you to triangulate upon reality. I mean, in other words, if all you've got is awake and asleep, you can't go far with that. But if you've got awake, asleep, and DMT as points, you can build a much more dimensionally rich model of consciousness. I think that it has to do with your own intelligence. Truly stupid people aren't interested in psychedelics because they can't figure out what the point of it is. It feeds off intelligence. It's a consciousness-expanding drug. If you don't have any consciousness, it can't expand it. And I've met people who say, all this stuff and big bugs talk to you and say strange stuff. You say, you should have paid a little attention. It's amazing to me how people don't seem to, the less intelligent you are, the less challenging the psychedelic experience becomes, because the less capable of entertaining the implications you are. Because you just say, a lot of bright lights and there's some talking bugs and spaceships and I don't know. It's because because those people are so ingrained in cultural values that they assume it's not real. They assume it's a trip, whatever that means. It means you have permission not to take this experience seriously. It's a trip. But what I've noticed is that based on quantum mechanics' need for an observer as part of any system, that's big news for our field of study, because what it means is hallucinations are as real as anything else. I mean, a hallucination is not like a Chevrolet, but on the other hand, a Chevrolet is not like a hallucination. Why should we demand that these things co-map over each other? A hallucination is a species of reality, as capable of teaching you as a videotape about Kilimanjaro or anything else that falls through your life. The question is, does DMT talk to you the way psilocybin does? It's interesting that these two compounds, so closely related to each other, both have something to say about language, but they say it in precisely opposite ways. Psilocybin, it's a teaching voice that speaks to you in your language. I had a very interesting experience that was an example of this to me. When I first started growing mushrooms, I had to do a lot of batch testing. And so I was taking mushrooms a lot. And I would get into these places with it where it would say, da 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 says, says, it would make these declarative statements, and then it would always put the word says on the end of the sentence. I thought, weird, but what do you expect of a talking vegetable? What's weird and what isn't? So then I heard Wasson's publication called Maria Savina and Her Mushroom Velada. It's a set of six tapes of a mushroom session that Maria Savina did in 1956. So here is Maria Savina raving in Mazatec, and it's going along like this. Da 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 da. Tsuh. Tsuh. And I look in the interlinear translation. Tsuh means says in Mazatec. So she's hearing it in Mazatec. I'm hearing it in English. So that's what psilocybin is capable of. What happens with DMT is it doesn't speak to you in English. It speaks to you in Elfish, and you understand. And under sufficiently hyped up conditions, you are able to reply. In other words, psilocybin pushes your brain state towards some kind of spontaneous glossolalia. And I think that this probably is mixed up with the generation of language itself. Because what happens on DMT, on high-dose DMT, is these machine elves, these dribbling basketball things, they use this musical sing-sang-song language to make objects, which they then show you. They're like machines or animals or crystals or crosses between, I don't know, consomme and something else. They have these opalescent depths. They're neither matter nor mind, neither solid nor liquid, but they make these things and set them loose in this environment, and these things themselves are emitting language and making other things. So they make machines which make machines. Everybody's chattering, squeaking, crawling over each other, clamoring for your attention. And what they're trying to do is to get you to produce this glossolalia. For some reason, which I cannot imagine why, when you're stoned and you do the glossolalia, it's an incredibly pleasurable experience. But so might be eating an orange or having sex if you were to do it at that moment. You can't tell. But you can make this funny pseudo-linguistic stream of syllables that's very, very satisfying. And, you know, it has a bit of art in it. I think probably we invented language long before meaning, and that it was some very practical person who got the idea that the music could have words, and that before that it was simply verbal amusement. After all, the most readily at hand musical instrument is the human voice. I think that language as we practice it this afternoon in this room is an uncompleted enterprise, that language wants to be visual. It is in transition. Remember, it's from the silence of prehistory to the visual language beyond the eschaton, and the overlapping of silence and visual language gives you audio language. The more perfect logos would be beheld. This is what Philo Judaeus taught. And considering that many of these psychedelic compounds involved in the language phenomena, like DMT and harmine and harmaline, these all occur as part of human metabolism, ordinarily. And I think that it's possible that we are on the cusp of an evolutionary transformation of language having to do with an actual change in our physique, in our genetic output. Because why is it that monoamine oxidase inhibiting compounds like harmaline, specifically 5-methoxytetrahydroharmalan, occurs in the pineal gland and is... The pineal gland has always been thought of as somehow connected to the soul. It was the seat of the soul for Descartes. And I think that maybe what history is the rather muddled situation that occurs in an animal species while it perfects a true language. And that we're not there yet, folks, because a true language is beheld. I think that the real nub of what we're trying to get at here is that the world is mental in some way that we do not yet understand, but that which we're edging toward understanding. And the world is made of language. I can't say that enough. And so whenever we get into these discussions about reality or effects in space and time, we are operating outside this assumption that the world is made of language. If the world is made of language, it's very hard to figure out just where the edge of it is. I mean, do we really need to believe in the existence of distant galaxies like NGC 245 if, in fact, the world is being produced in the human cerebellum as a phenomenon of language? What exactly is the ontological status of these distant parts of the universe that register only as the faint tracings on our instruments, then interpreted through the fishy fiat of a bunch of stacked up theories and formulas? I mean, did you know that the entire universe of radio telescopy, radio telescopes were invented around 1950. They've been used to build up our entire picture of the universe. Did you know that if you took all the energy that has fallen on all the radio telescopes on this planet since the invention of radio telescopy, that it would be less energy than is generated by a cigarette ash falling a distance of 2 feet? So that's where your data sample is coming from, that you've built up this model of exploding galaxies and colliding quasars and mega this and mega that. I mean, it's pretty flimsy stuff, folks, compared to the meat of the moment in which we find ourselves. Now, magical philosophies, which are have about 50 to 100,000 years under their belt, as opposed to science, which goes back to the Renaissance, magical philosophies have always claimed that the world is made of language, that the world is a thing of words. And if you know these words, you can take it apart and put it together any old way you wish. Our entire Western religious tradition begins with the incredibly cryptic statement, in principio et verbum et verbo caro factum est. It's fairly obscure even in English. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was made flesh. What is this making the Word into flesh? And does it not imply then that eventually the flesh will become Word? As I descend into mental disintegration and madness, I become more and more convinced that reality is more like a novel than a series of integrated tensor equations of the third degree, which is what physics would have us believe. The world is like a novel. It's a novel in which you are a character. And there's dramatic tension, plot, resolution, tragedy, nobility, betrayal, the whole gamut of emotions and human possibilities. And what we tend to do is always to marginalize first our own experience and then all human experience. So our model of reality is that the universe is a zillion somethings that direction and a trillion somethings that direction. We are tiny and insignificant. Our star is typical. Our galaxy is typical. Everything is utterly humdrum. And there's nothing going on here at all. Well, this is an incredibly dreary and disempowering model of reality. I would rather believe that if, in fact, what the universe is a novelty-producing and conserving engine. And if we define novelty as density of connectedness, then guess what? The human neocortex becomes the center of the cosmic drama. Because the human neocortex is the most densely ramified and connected material object known to exist in the universe. So after 1,000 years of human marginalization, suddenly through the injection of science, there is permission to believe that the cosmic drama really is about us, that we really do carry the load in this play, that this is a play about the career and preservation of novelty and complexity, and thus we are central actors in that drama. And hence, if something were to happen to us and our enterprise, the universe would be vastly impoverished by that loss. Well, now we're on the brink of decoding the human genome, and we will use computers to do this because we're going to have to keep absolute track of millions of units, of strings of characters. But the end result of this, I think, is that the flesh will be made word, and that we are textualizing our reality. And this may be what all these French people are screaming about that we can't understand, the so-called deconstructionists, because they keep saying reality, it should be dealt with as a text. If you don't treat it as a text, you will entirely miss the point of it. Well, I've been thinking about this for a while, and first of all, my life is very strange, because when I hit the mushroom at La Chirera in 1971, Interpol was looking for me. I had a price on my head. I had no money. I had blown my college education. I had no job skills. I had nothing. And that is, of course, as all folklorists know, the precondition for exaltation. If you're not poor and humble, I mean, what's the point, you know? So I was poor and humble, and then I got crossed up with this mushroom, and immediately life became art. Life became freakishly ordered, and plot elements began to unfold. And I have in my mind a picture of the curve of my mission, if you want to call it that. And weirdly enough, reality has not yet departed from the curve. Now, the curve is getting steeper and steeper, and at some point, surely, reality and the curve will depart. Otherwise, decency forbids that I carry that thought further. But you do see what I mean, I think. And all of us are beginning to take textual control of our lives and be able to write the plot. You see, if what we're embedded in is a novel or some work of art like a novel, then what you want to do is figure out who in the novel you are. I mean, if your name is Joe Blow, is the name of this novel The Lives and Worlds of Joe Blow? Or do you get to draw a bath for someone on page 230 and never be seen again? Now, as a character, the more conscious you become, the more you have free will within the context of the plot. I never understood this, and I'm not sure most people understand it. Like I grew up in Berkeley in the 19—I was in Berkeley from 65 to 70, the golden age. I was so unconvinced of my own uniqueness that I never understood that the great drama that was unfolding around me, all I had to do was join, and I never joined. I thought it was spectator sport. I mean, I marched in the marches, I took acid, I got laid, I did all of those things. But what I mean by I didn't join is I didn't realize that the Grateful Dead were a bus ride away and that I could probably walk into that scene and make a place for myself. Or the Doors, or the Stones, or the Beatles. You pick it. In other words, I define myself as a spectator rather than an actor. And we are all doing that far too much. You can get a lot rowdier than you are. You can make a lot more waves. There's been too much politesse and too much parlor etiquette exercised recently by the counterculture. It's perfectly all right to mix things up. It's perfectly all right to try and accelerate the plot. This will move your character nearer and nearer to the center of the action. And people have asked me then, is the goal to make yourself the novel about you? Is the goal to make the novel about yourself? I don't think so. The goal is to become the author of the novel. Then you can write any damn ending you want for your character or any other. And this becoming the author is this psychedelic detachment. And suddenly you go from being a chessman on the board to the chess master looking at the board. It's empowering. It's self-control. Now, people who don't know this are like made of denser stuff than the rest of us. You can just part them like wheat and move through them because they have no sense of the nature of the game. They are still embedded in the old Newtonian paradigm and are completely powerless to control their own lives. That's what happens to you in the Newtonian game. All the power flows to, I don't know, the White House, the UN, Madison Avenue. It's not clear, but it certainly doesn't reside with you. More and more, I think we need to decondition. That's what I mean by following the plot as written. If you never decondition, you're just a character in somebody else's story. But if you decondition, you can begin to move your life the way you want. And miracles happen. Miracles do happen. They happen even to ordinary people in the realm of falling in love, because there's something about where the genes go that is very compelling to the universal logos that's watching over us all. So, you know, the stable boy can marry the princess if his heart is pure and the winds of the logos are at his back. That's why we love those fairy tales of the stable boy who inherits the kingdom, because we sense that as our story. The question is, how can you bring back the psychedelic experience, or what can you bring? I know of two techniques, neither very satisfying, both in combination, moderately effective, but crude. The first is a voice-operated tape recorder. They sell these for a couple of $100. I've produced some amazing tapes with these. I have one voice-activated tape where you hear me clear my throat 200 times in the course of an evening, because each time I would clear my throat, halfway through the throat clearing, it's voice-activated, the tape recorder, so it would catch the last half of however, if you have presence of mind sufficient to speak English, this would be a more informative record of your experience. Yeah. And then the other technique, which is less technically dependent, is if you have an insight at a certain level of the experience, you have to repeat it to yourself at another level of the experience. And then another level. And by this incremental bucketing method, you can carry almost any insight out into the realm of the world. these insights often don't stand up to scrutiny. I had a really interesting experience just a week ago. I'm sure you've all had most of this experience, but I finally had it all. It's the experience of having a dream, a very, very complicated dream, the subject of which is the universal secret, which if told would transform everything. It's the I've got it phenomenon. And usually what happens is you wake up and it's gone just before you get consciousness together. And you say, my God, I understood everything. Yes. I had it down to a single statement. If I could articulate it, the world would never be the same. Well, this happened to me about a week ago, but by some miracle, I actually was able to hang on to the statement into consciousness. And I woke up and yelled this thing. My son was appalled. I mean, it was 6:30 in the morning, and I was able to get it out. I hope you're ready. I sat straight up in bed and said, a song is a song. Profound stuff. I mean, maybe it is profound stuff. The profound stuff usually has that an X is an X construct, because essentially what it's telling you is silence would have been an acceptable substitute for this statement. Well, let me say one more thing here, just sort of to wind this up. The metaphor that makes sense for what we're going through, because it gets the biology of it, it gets the drama of it, it gets the risk of it, it gets the fun and the joy of it, is the metaphor of birth. We are about to decamp from three-dimensional space and time. Yes, the earth is the cradle of mankind, but you can't live in the cradle forever. And we're not in this cradle alone. We are squashing and trampling on hundreds of other species that have as much right to be here as we are. So through technology, which means pharmacology, art, and the engineering sciences, we are trying to find a doorway into a new world for the spirit. And it is going to come out of human-machine interfacing, pharmacological redesign of the human brain-mind system, down possibly digitalizing and downloading into the microphysical realm. We don't know. I mean, if it makes your hair stand on end to think of being downloaded into the digital realm, there was once a fish who had a great deal of doubts about this plan to conquer the land and tried to urge everyone to think again that no good could possibly come of it. But in fact, the forward thrust of evolution is toward higher dimensions, greater complexity, more information, greater connectedness, and a deeper and deeper sense of the all-pervasiveness of love and meaning. That's what it's really about. All these disparate physical elements come to nothing if they don't add up to more than the sum of their parts. And the more than the sum of their parts is this transcendental element which we call love. That is the part of the eschaton that has never left us, that accompanied us across the African grassland and into history. I mean, granted, bloodied and battered by the experiences of sexism and racism and so forth, but never lost as an ideal, never lost as a guiding light and an experience. And I really think that when we dissolve all the boundaries, this is what we will discover, is an unconditional caring, an unconditional affection that flows through all life and all matter and gives it meaning. And you don't have to wait for the end of the world to get this news. You can just short-circuit the collective march toward that realization by accelerating your own microcosm of spirituality through the use of these hallucinogens. They are the doorways that the Gaian mind has installed in the historical process to let anybody out anytime they want to, provided they have the courage to turn the knob and walk through the door. Thank you very, very much. Thanks.